And now we turn to a genocide that occurred 10 years ago in Africa. One of the most heartbreaking scenes in the new film Hotel Rwanda takes place midway through the picture about the 1994 Rwandan genocide. In the first half, we watch the country rapidly descend into madness through the eyes of Hutu hotel manager Paul Ruiz Abagania. And he's managed to keep alive 1,268 Tutsis and moderate Hutus who took refuge at the Hotel Mille Collines with the strength of his wits and the ability to pay bribes. The moment comes when Paul, played by actor Don Cheadle, tells the group that the foreign troops have come not to save them or to stop the pending slaughter, but to evacuate themselves and all Western citizens from Rwanda.
There will be no rescue, no intervention force. We can only save ourselves. Many of you know influential people abroad. You must call these people.
Please, fax this to us.
You must tell them what will happen to us.
Yes.
Say goodbye. But when you say goodbye, say it as though you are reaching through the phone and holding their hand. Let them know that if they let go of that hand, you will die. We must shame them into sending help.
Don Cheadle, the actor, as Paul Ruiz Abagania. 10 years ago, the West chose to ignore what went on in Rwanda. Now, director Terry George's film, The Hotel Rwanda, makes it a little bit more difficult to do so. If you have a question about Rwanda or what happened back in 1994, you can give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be speaking with Mr. Ruiz Abagania, but joining us now is the writer and director of Hotel Rwanda, Terry George. He's at our New York Bureau. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Your movie opens tomorrow in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, then to wider audiences around the country in January. Can you give us a brief synopsis of the story?
Yes, well, basically it tells the story of Paul Ruiz Abagania, who was a hotel manager at the Micheline Hotel in Kigali in 1994. He is Hutu, his wife is Tutsi. And during when the genocide broke out, he was first of all, his house was used as shelter by 26 of his neighbors. He managed to transport those people who were Tutsi to the hotel, and when he got there, he discovered that there had been a huge influx of refugees into the hotel, Hutu moderates and Tutsis who were fearful of their lives. And over the course of the next 100 days, Paul managed to shelter those people despite being abandoned by the West and the United Nations. And can I just say, Neil, I listened to the last discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And if people want to see what goes on the ground while the semantics we just listened to take place, they should go and see Hotel Rwanda. Because I've just listened to the same language that I read being spoken in 1994, you know, about UN forces having the right to intervene if they see someone being hurt and how we're trying to do our best and we're encouraging the African Union or we're encouraging the UN. And we're encouraging the Security Council. And these are the exact same words that were spoken in 1994. And our current president, George Bush, wrote in a report on Rwanda, not on my watch. Well, I'm afraid it is happening on his watch. And if people want to see, like I said, the effect of ordinary people in Darfur and Sudan, they should go and see Hotel Rwanda because it's a mirror image of what's going on now.
Tell us a little bit more about the movie business. It is difficult to make films these days about Africa in general. How much trouble was it to... This is not a conventional film by Hollywood standards. How difficult was it to get made?
Well, basically, none of the major studios were willing to fund the film. It's a film about Africa with black actors in the principal roles, and it's about the genocide in Rwanda. And that subject matter, or the tone of that subject matter, doesn't appeal to studios. But we managed to raise the money independently in the United Kingdom and South Africa and Italy, and then to persuade MGM UA to distribute it. They felt that it was a powerful film and could find an audience. And so now we're out there hopeful that it will find such an audience.
Let's bring some listeners into the conversation. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Peter is with us from Berkeley, California.
Yes, thank you for dealing with this topic. I wanted to ask where Mr. George gets the emotional strength to deal with this. It would seem to me so devastating. I mean, just listening to that little bit of the show or putting my attention on it causes me to be extremely emotional. And I'm wondering what it must be like for you, and if you could comment on that.
Yeah, well, I get the emotional strength from Paul Rousset-Sabagina. He's alive. He's living in Brussels, Belgium. He's an amazing person. And ultimately, the film is a film of hope and inspiration. I think the initial attitude of people or their perceptions might be that, oh, my God, this is terrible. But I think if you read the reviews that come out and talk to people who've seen it, it's not like that at all. It's a message of hope for us that an ordinary man, using his skills, can find courage that we hope we'll all be able to tap into.
Peter, thanks very much for the question, but it seems this is the perfect moment to bring in Paul Rousset-Sabagina himself. He joins us on the line from Brussels in Belgium, where he lives now. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
It must be strange to hear yourself spoken of that way.
Well, it was not very strange because I'm a little bit getting used to such scenes, to such even live programs.
As you look back on the situation, was there any one moment when you were involved 10 years ago there in Rwanda where you had to make a decision to go ahead with this effort to save these people, obviously at the risk of your own life, or was it just a gradual process?
Well, in 1994, the only thing I was sure of, I was going to be killed. And before I was killed, that was my decision. I was supposed to do something. And in any case, I believe that each and every person has got his own day to die. So I was always, every day, every minute, every hour, I was expecting my day to come.
So
and before it came, I had to stick on my only and my own ideas.
So
which were to help the people up to the end.
But day by day, minute by minute, this was nothing you said, I can do this for a few weeks and then stop?
Oh, well, you could know. I never had that time to sit down and think about it and take a decision and set rules and regulations of how I was going to operate and have time to get to be in fear or something.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you both a question, and please help us out. The Hutus and the Tutsis, the different groups there in Rwanda, seem so intertwined within the community. Can you explain to outsiders the kind of tension that led to the kind of mass murder that we saw 10 years ago?
Well, basically, before the colonists arrived, first the Germans and the Belgians, there was a feudal society where the Tutsi were the cattle herders and the wealthier and the Hutu, and that word means people who work for someone else, were the agricultural workers. When the Germans arrived, they decided, as all colonial powers did, that they needed an elite to run the country for them, and they started to divide up the two into Tutsi and Hutus and issue ID cards, and they based their perceptions on that sort of Germanic master race theory, where the Tutsi were taller, they said, and more elegant and closer to whites. And then the Belgians perpetuated this division by going around measuring people's noses, studying the width of their noses, studying the color of their skin, and completely divided the society. Then over the course of the 50 years that the Belgians were there, they created such animosity between the Tutsi and the Hutu that when they left in 1961, the Hutu majority immediately turned on the Tutsi minority and drove many of them out of the country. Following that, a Hutu extremist government took power. And just as was spoken about in Darfur, on the basis of wealth and controlling the wealth of that country, they institutionalized the division and demonized the Tutsi. And in 1990, when a Tutsi rebel army began to fight their way back into Rwanda, a certain radio station controlled by the Hutu began to call for the slaughter of all Tutsi. and referred to the Tutsi population as cockroaches. In 1994, the extremist Hutu president, Habyarimana, was assassinated when his plane was shot from the sky, and that sparked off the genocide that took place in April 6, 1994.
We're speaking with the director and writer of the new film, Hotel Rwanda. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Bradford. Bradford's calling from New York.
Yes, I am, sir. That movie was the most... I actually saw the movie. I have a friend who works at AmeriCares, and she was invited to an advanced screening and took me, and it was the most magnificent film I've ever seen. Only through the anonymity of radio will I admit that I cried through most of it.
Paul Rousses Abagina, you were a consultant on the movie. Obviously, you've seen it. What do you think of it?
Well, the movie is a good result of what I told the filmmakers. You know, before they made this movie, I first of all met Terry Jones in Brussels, and we came to an agreement. And after coming to an agreement, he invited me to his house in Long Island. We stayed together for 5 days. In the course of those five days, we sat together. I told them my story, and then they also wrote. And after 5 days, I came back to Brussels, and they sat down and drafted a script. And they submitted me a copy of it, and we again sat down and thought about it and changed a few things here and there. And then when they started also filming, before starting even filming, I went down to South Africa. I met with Don Cheadle, and when they were filming, I was there. I was following each and every detail, and for 15 days I stayed, and afterwards I also went again, right in the middle towards the end of filming. I went again for another 15 days, and I stayed there. I was following the movie, so I was aware of what was being done. The movie is actually a result, a good result, 90% almost of what I told the film writers.
Bradford, thank you.
Welcome, sir.
And let's talk now with Angelique. And Angelique is calling from Long Island.
Yes, hello. I was listening to your conversation earlier, and I'm looking forward to what promises to be a stunning film. But I had a question about something you said earlier about studios not wanting to take on films that involve dealing with things like Africa or taking on primarily African-American cast or African cast, black cast. Black actors. I was wondering if, Terry, you had any idea why that is.
And if you could say why you think it is in about 30 seconds, that would be helpful, Terry.
Okay.
Yeah, it's financial. There's a perception, and it may not be wrong, that films about Africa with black actors do not make a profit either here in the United States or across the world.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Terry. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Terry George is the writer and director of the new movie Hotel Rwanda. And we also need to thank Paul Rousses Abagina for joining us on the line from Brussels. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome, sir.
And a good day to you.
And you too. Thank you.
The new film Hotel Rwanda is opening shortly in selected cities in around the country. And then in January, it will be more widely available in theaters near you. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.